From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park Podcast.
Welcome to this very special episode of the Bletchley Park Podcast, the best of reunions, part two. As I explained in the last show, due to COVID-19 restrictions and with huge regret, Bletchley Park Trust had to take the difficult decision not to host our annual Veterans Reunion on site this year. This is the second of three special episodes we'll be bringing you this month to still pay tribute to our veterans. Reunion is always the busiest day of the year for us, catching up with old friends and rushing around trying to make sure that we can record as many veterans as we can on the day. So over the 8 years of the podcast, it hasn't just been our original co-host Catherine Lynch and me capturing those memories. We've also had some help from a group of people we like to call our roving reporters. They're all friends of the podcast who kindly give their time to help us to allow the veterans to tell their stories in their own voices. I'll have no doubt missed a few along the way, but I say thank you to everyone who's helped us since 2012, but especially to those whose interviews are featured in this episode. Sarah Langston, Kerry Howard, Astrid Specht, Helen Lee, and of course, Catherine.
Bletchley Station.
So you could go just here? Yeah. Okay, can I have everyone's attention, please? You all need to look in here, bizarrely. Right, here we go. Can everyone look towards me, please? Oh, hang on, let's have a look. Oh, it's a good one. Hang on, let's do that again. Very nice. And for all time's sake, let's do one more, and then we're done. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you.
Can I just say something before everyone moves? Obviously, this is a very, very important day for us. We are so proud to have all our veterans back with us today from the outstation. Before they move, can I just ask, can we have three cheers, please? Hip, hip!
Hooray!
Hip, hip!
Hooray!
Hip, hip!
Hooray!
Now you can clap.
Hooray!
There we go. And do you like to be Florence or Flo?
Flo.
Flo.
Everyone call me Flo.
When did you join up, or were you called up?
1943, but I was called up.
Did you pick the WAF?
Well, it was a bit difficult at the time because I've got two brothers in the RAF, which were called up, and I was very upset when I had to go to be registered, and all they could offer me was to be in the army. Oh, dear, I thought. Strangely enough, I just said, oh, I can't go in the army. My brothers are in the Air Force. So this particular person that was interviewing me, she said, well, I'm sorry, you've got to go in the army. I said, I'm sorry, hang on, I've got to go home and ask my mother whether... And when I got home, my mother said, definitely not the army. You've got to go and follow your brothers.
Well, your brothers wouldn't have let you live it down, would they?
Oh, dear. I was really scared.
Yeah.
Because I thought, oh, my gosh, if I don't do this. So I said to my mother, could you come with me? Because I was scared. She said, oh, don't be silly. Just go back and tell them your mother has told me to tell you that you can't go in the army. And I went back and she said, oh, it's you again. And I said, yes. I said, you better change pretty quick. I'm not going in the army. I've got to go. My mother's told me. I can always remember. Anyway, the outcome of it all is I did go in the Air Force. But it was fun in those days. It's awfully difficult. I've tried so hard over the years to try and impose what I feel then and still remember. We were living in another world. Mm. Really and truly, I find it difficult.
I don't think people today understand how all-encompassing that war was. Not just for people serving, but for people at home, on the home front. Everyone was involved, weren't they?
But when I went home on leave, my mother never asked me what I did, and I never told her.
Hush, hush.
It was very strange, because you'd have thought one of the family would have said, well, what were you doing? No, never.
To this day, I've still not heard a veteran say, one of their family members, apart from saying, oh, what are you doing? The first time, maybe, and the veteran say, I can't tell you.
Strange?
It was a different attitude, wasn't it?
It's a different world. And we live for the day. We never thought of tomorrow.
No.
That was the time we were living in. And it was a really slow process. We weren't rushing here, there and everywhere. It was, once again, I find it difficult to express myself. But when I went home on leave, and I'm Birmingham born, we were right by the BSA Canal. One evening, I was home on leave, and we had to go in this shelter in the garden. And there were 12 in that particular shelter. Mm. A 13-gallon oil bomb fell at the back of the 3 shelters. And it was frightening because we were stuck there and finally the bomb disposal men came. The nearest place to keep us safe was where the nuns were, which was only about 10-minute walk. And we went down in this crypt, all of us. Yes, and they fed us. And the very next night, it was bombed to the ground. So, do you call that luck?
I think you're very lucky.
I think we were.
But I suppose going home and seeing that, because a lot of veterans we have felt at the time, you know, they couldn't see what they were doing, how that was helping the war.
That's very true.
But, you know, you could go home, see that that bombing was happening and know that you were doing something that was helping.
But when I think back now, it must have been very important. But I've always thought it wasn't.
That's the thing. All of you are so modest.
Well, all these years, I've always felt, yes, I did that. But I've never considered myself important enough to talk and say, I did this or I did that. No, I've been very quiet about it for the last 70 years.
So many of you have. Mm. That's the reason why people now are so in awe of our veterans, because they can't believe that you could do that for 70 years. And every single one of you was important. Every single one of you was a tiny cog in this big machine. From the most famous code breaker down to the tea girl, everyone was important.
I suppose you're right, but I've never felt I was very special or anything like that, because, you know, I don't know. It's just part of the way I feel about it all.
You're all so similar. I haven't heard one bragging veteran ever. You're all so modest.
What a strange thing.
And all I can say is thank you for your service.
Oh, how kind of you to say that. I can look back now and feel, yes, maybe we did contribute a little bit.
Well, you definitely did. And
thank you.
Man with lots of slips of paper, with groups of, I was trying to remember actually, groups of letters all the way across the whole thing, with all groups of 4 or 5 letters, the whole bleak slip. And then we had a code thing that we had to work out on, which so many down, so many up, so many.
What's your name, first of all? Now, I know, but it's for the tape.
Cecily Pickering.
And was it Pickering during the war, or is that your name?
It was Anderson.
Anderson. And what did you do?
I was on the bombs at Stanmore and at Eastcote.
Was that towards the end of the war when there were lots and lots of bombs?
Yes. Oh, yes, yes. Well, I didn't go in until 1944, so...
We weren't old enough, I shouldn't think we.
I was just old enough, yes.
But not until 1944?
No,
yeah.
No.
So what was it like? What are your memories of that time?
Oh, I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I can tell from your tone that you've heard that lots of your colleagues didn't enjoy it so much.
Really?
Well, that it was hard. It was, you know, the shifts were very grueling, I've heard.
And I never found it particularly hard, I don't think. And I quite enjoyed it.
it got youth through. For you.
Well, yes. And no, I'll be nice. It was smelly. And but you got good time off, you see, in between. So that was very good. And you had time off during the day. With the shifts, you could get up to London and that. And actually, where I was, I could actually get home from...
Where was home?
Well, home was at Totteridge. And so from both East Coast and Stanmore, I could either, you know, I could get home. I could get home on by bus from one of them.
And well, considering you could have been posted to any corner of the world, really, with the Navy, couldn't you?
That's right, yes.
So fast forward, say, 30 years, when you found out, you know, how the whole thing fitted together, what was that like? I know that as bomb operators, you perhaps had slightly more privileged information than many who were cogs in the machine, because you would be told, I understand.
We knew what I was going to say. I would say we knew what we were doing.
And how important it was.
And yes, and every now and again, somebody would come down from the Admiralty, give us a little pep talk and tell us something that had happened that was sort of thanks to us.
The effect
you know.
You'd had, yeah.
So, yes, we did know. We knew what effect we were having. And yes, we'd got quite a good idea, which is why it's so amazing that it kept... that you never got out.
So when it did start to come out, that must have been quite shocking for you.
Well, it wasn't until the 70s, I think, that I actually told my husband what I'd been doing. You know. No, you just sort of...
How did he take it?
Didn't think all that much of it, sort of thing.
What did he do during the war?
Oh, he was in the British Air Arm. It was intriguing, really, the way it didn't come out. All that everybody knew, and it was all sort of... talk about what was going on when I was at East Coast and that, sort of what was going on in what was a populated area, you know.
What's it like to come back now after all these years? I know that you weren't stationed here, but obviously this is where it's all celebrated and told.
Well, I've never bothered about coming back before, but my daughter saw the invitation and she was keen to come and see it all. But yes, it's interesting. Interesting as far as I'm concerned, because although I came here, I didn't stay very long because I just got married and it was the end of the war. And they said, well, what do you want to do? Will you be staying or will you go? And I said, oh, I'll be going. So I didn't stay very long here. I didn't really get to know Bletchley Park at all.
Was it your idea to have a brick in the wall with your name on, or was that your family?
Well, I sort of, my daughter saw it and said, oh, yes, oh, you must do that.
You're under instruction. How does it feel now you see it?
Oh, yes, it's very nice, actually. And it's interesting, yes, looking up there. But the funny thing is, you don't remember names, or very few of them. And I'm going to be interested to see if I do remember any of them.
Yeah. Well, enjoy your day. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
No, Japanese. I didn't know it was Japanese until I saw it during the book. Probably didn't know what we were doing. I mean, there was no idea what we were doing.
Can you just tell me how you first came here?
Yes, my mother knew Captain Bradshaw, and I think my mother must have been talking to him about me, because he said, bring her up, because I wasn't learning anything at school. I was in a temporary hut as a school in Bletchley, because we evacuated here. And he asked me one or two questions, what were my hobbies, and did I enjoy reading, and I must have answered the right questions for him. I was interviewed in here in the house, in one of the corridors near the kitchen.
When you come in here now, does it take you right back to that time?
I know the feel of the ground. This is from being a messenger, because I tramped for 2 years with all the messages around the park, and I knew where the soft parts were and the more difficult parts, and I knew exactly how the ground felt. I can still feel it when I come in. I have taken people over the house because being a messenger, you had to know where everybody was because you had to take things everywhere. All of the important parts had names to them, you see. We used to have at least 4 or 5 deliveries that we had to make a day. And my department, when I was so young, used to close at about 6 o'clock, I think, because I wasn't allowed to work beyond certain hours because of my age.
So you were the baby of the park, really?
Well, one of them. I think there were about five of us. And most of, I think, were probably older than me. I don't remember ever knowing that they were doing code breaking here. I never knew that. I used to see the papers with the figures and letters on them, but it didn't mean a thing to me. I wasn't interested. I was a child.
Do you remember when you learned how important what had happened here was?
Well, I just knew. You see, I must have signed the Official Secrets Act at least four times. And even then, we were told that for 30 years, you had to remain silent. And when Hugh Lungi, on my interview for Bush House, when he saw I worked at Bletchley, asked me what was I doing, you know, I just said, I'm sorry, I can't discuss that. I'm under the Official Secrets Act. And I didn't know then that he knew a lot about it. Not only that, and I didn't know this, and I only know it now because he became head of my department in Bush House. He was one of the few interpreters at the Anglo-Russian talks with Stalin. I've seen him a lot on film since the end of the war. I didn't know what he was when he interviewed me. Nothing was said. And until such time as the act was lifted, must have been about 1975 or so, I still didn't know that it had something to do with us before the war. My mother and my older sister worked here as well, and my sister worked in Hut 10 for Josh Cooper, and I never ever knew what she did, and I had to go over there sometimes with messages, but of course we didn't speak in the office until the day I turned up for work in her clothes. I felt I had nothing decent to wear at home. I put on a new blouse and skirt of hers, never thinking I would be sent to Hut 10 to deliver a message to one of the WAF officers there. I walked into the room, and my sister was sitting there. I crept past her desk, and I just handed her what I had to give her, turned round, and as I walked, I had to pass my sister's desk. As I walked past, I saw her eyes more than her head turn and say, "You wait until I get you home."
That's wonderful.
And I didn't know what to do. And I'd split her blouse here on the seams.
And did you get it when you got home?
Well, there was a big row. My mother said, "You're not going to touch her," you know. And that's how secretive everything was. I was an embarrassment to her here anyway. And she said, "I don't ever tell anybody you're my sister." She was ashamed. But when I was put upstairs, I had no idea that it was such an important department until I was working in it. Everything was plain language. But I still don't remember seeing anything uncoded, I mean. Not that we worked on codes in there, as far as I know. But for all I know, we might have done. I didn't. But I was taught to type when I was in that office and was able to take a job as a typist after I left Eastcote.
Well, it's a privilege to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for asking me.
Classified in Hut 3, the three military and three air section, classified the messages into four grades. The first grade was, this is absolutely top priority, has to go out within sort of 2 or 3 hours. Second grade was, it needs to go out to whoever, really, before the end of the shift. Third grade was, we'll do it when we can, and it may go out in hard copy form. The fourth grade, and it's the German for nonsense, rubbish.
Quatsch.
Yes, that's it. Mm-hmm. And that's what they called it here.
Right.
It was nonsense. And you can just imagine a bunch of academics and military officers saying, "We'll call it." You said it completely different to how I do.
You'll be glad I recorded this.
I'm glad you studied in Germany.
So it was all...
Come on, you don't normally get stage fright.
I don't. I didn't realise you were recording me. So it was quite a complex process for how they actually produced that intelligence. And we talk a lot about the decoding, which is where Hut 3 is fantastic. Because for the first time, we're really talking about now how the messages came in and how they went through the different sections, the advisors, through to producing the intelligence before them going out.
Anyway, we're going to have a wander around the back.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Hello and good afternoon. May I ask your name?
Kay Wingate.
What brought you to Bletchley today?
Because it's a reunion, and I have been coming for a few years now and staying for the weekend at Burris Potos. So many of my friends that used to come with me, they're not here anymore. I've either died or too far away to come. So I've just come for the day, and as it's a family occasion, I thought the family would like to come and have a look around.
What did you do?
I was never stationed at Bletchley, but I was one of the outstations. We were intercepting mainly German signals.
Did you enlist?
No, I was conscripted when I was 19. I wanted to be in the ATS because I wanted to be a driver. But they said, oh, we've got too many drivers. And I said, I didn't want to work in the office or any office work because I was already working in an office. And then they mentioned about the signals. So I said, yes, all right. I didn't know what it was going to be about. When I first joined up, we had 6 months of training on the Isle of Man. And then I was posted to Harrogate in Yorkshire, which was a very nice place, but used to be taken up onto the Yorkshire Moors where there was a wireless station. There were four watches. There was A, B, C and D. And my mother wanted to know why I wasn't in A. I was in B watch. She wanted to know why I wasn't in A because A came before B. You know, it was a silly little thing. We'd start off our rota at midday until 7 o'clock in the evening. Then we'd have to get up early in the next morning, go 7 till 1. Then we'd be on again at midnight until 7 in the morning. And again, 7 in the evening till midnight. Then we'd have the next day off.
Long hours.
So there were 7 hours concentrating, listening in all the time, you know. And yes, it was very boring at times because there's nothing happening, you know, no signals or anything. It was all very secret. We didn't know what we were doing ourselves, you know. And if we had have known, perhaps we'd have taken more interest in what was going on, but it was all very hush-hush.
Were you allowed to talk about what you were doing?
No, no. We had to sign the Secrets Act. Couldn't mention anything at all about what we were doing. As I say, we didn't know ourselves what we were doing, so we couldn't really say very much. It was interesting in the end. I met lots of people, made friends, and still keep in touch. Mind you, one of my friends that used to come here, she died last year. I've just met one other person that's come today.
So what did you do after the war?
Well, I went back to the job that I had left, which was in Brook Bonds, the tea firm, but I didn't go back to the same job because somebody else had taken my place, but they had to take you back. But before I'd even joined up, I was evacuated out into the country with Brook Bonds. And where I was evacuated, I met my husband. He was corresponding all through the war. He was in the RAF in the Middle East, but we both survived. Well, he survived, and we got married in 1948.
Did you ever speak to your husband about what you did in the war?
No, nothing. No.
When did you start talking about it?
In about 1976, when people started writing about it in books, and there was something on the television about it, and I said to my mother, oh, that's what I used to do. And I was so pleased to think it had come out into the open, you know, and I was so surprised because everybody knows about it now, you know.
How did your family react when they found out what you did?
Well, they were quite surprised because, my father had died, so he never knew. But my mother said, oh yes, you know, she was interested, but I don't think she realised what it was all about. But it was nice to be able to talk to other people about it.
When did you meet people who were involved with the same or similar kind of work?
Yes, well, somebody had written in Saga. They wanted to meet up with anybody that had been in the ATS in Harrogate, in Forest Moor, where I was. And so I wrote to her, and several people did, and we were invited to go to a territorial place in London where we could meet up. We used to have lunches up there.
And there were more people?
Yes. I've counted up just recently. I knew at least 15 people. And we used to come here. Now there's only myself and this other person, you know, that comes.
When was the first time you came to Bletchley Park?
Oh, gosh, now I can't remember. Well, it must be about 20 years ago when they first had these reunions.
Bletchley Park has changed quite considerably.
Oh, yes.
What do you think about the changes?
Well, I think it's a good thing, but when we first came, it was very dilapidated, you know, and I mean, it's grown so much and people are taking such an interest in us, but it's good to see what it was like, you know. But as I say, I was never here during the war, I've just seen myself on the Roll of Honour.
Wonderful.
Yes. Some of my friends come up here to have a look. They said, oh, saw your name on the Roll of Honour. And I thought, oh, good, Joe.
Do you think it's important to keep places like Bletchley Park alive?
Oh, yes, I do, really, yes. I mean, it's like the First World War now. I mean, this business in London with all the poppies and everything, it's lovely to think they've remembered that. And I think this will perhaps be the same sort of thing.
All the contributions you've made,
and everybody else. Oh, yes, yes. I mean, I'm pleased to think I've done something like this,
oh,
you know.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Thank you so much. Thank you for your time. It's wonderful to talk to you.
I'm Nancy Pumphrey, formerly Clark. When I joined up into the Rents, I had always hoped I might get a posting by the sea. And I was put into a coach with others, and we were told we were not to talk to each other, and we would be going on a ride to another department. And we set off. Well, of course, I knew the area because my father had done farming, and Bletchley had always had a big cattle market once
a
year. So I thought to myself, well, I know there. Well, actually, anyway.
You were probably the only person on the coach who did know.
Well, we don't talk. We were told on no account talk to each other. And so into the park we went, and we were taken into a room where we stood before two people, and one was that would we be prepared to work and not talk about it? Would we promise? And I said yes. And the next person said, will you please swear on the Bible?
Oh, really?
And so, yes, I swore on the Bible that I would not speak. And after the war, after about 30 years, someone wrote a book, and a lot of people came up to me and said, you're at Bletchley Park. And I said, but I took an oath.
Yes.
You've got plenty to read about. I shall not tell you anything. But, well, I'm now 96.
Well, you look very good for 96.
And once or twice to very special friends, I did say, well, you should go to Bletchley Park and see Hut 11, because that's where I was.
So Hut 11, you were a bomb operator then?
Yes, that's right.
So all and the stinky oil and the noise?
Oh, before we came out, we went through a curtain and we washed our hands and fingers with brushes, and then we showed them to an officer and she inspected them. Then she opened the door and we walked out into the hall, and then we went, if we were off duty, to a meal or whatever was we were up to for the next time, whether we were free for 8 hours or whether we were going to lunch or, you know.
Oh, that's brilliant. I've never been told about washing your hands as you came out.
Oh, my goodness, with the brush. Well, because all that grease and stuff off the bomb that you were plugging onto the wall, you had a map, you see, and you worked to the map. And sometimes the bristles crossed, and that caused a short.
And you had to have tweezers, didn't you?
Yes, I think.
To pull them out.
Yes, I also think I used my fingers.
Oh, really?
I think we all did anyway, or we sort of felt to see if it was. But yes, and then there were some gentlemen who were in the RAF.
Yes.
And if we had problems, we could speak to someone, an officer at the door, and say, please, may I have help?
We've actually got one of those gentlemen here today. There's a chap called Eric Hume, and he used to drive around here and Eastcote and Stanmore, wherever the bombs were. And he came and fixed the bombs.
Yes.
We'll have to find him for you sometime today, and you can tell him whether he did a good job when he was fixing the bombs or not.
Well, he did, whoever it was.
And so today you've got to see the Codebreakers Wall for the first time.
Yes.
So your name is now going to be here for forever, basically. How does that make you feel?
Well, I won't need a gravestone, will I? That'll be there for them to come and see. It'll be a cheap do for them, won't it?
Nancy, you're fantastic. But do you feel proud? Because you should do.
Well, it was for the King and the Queen and my country.
Exactly.
And I had a boyfriend and at that time, a boyfriend, and he was in France. And I thought, well, I think I'll join up too. I had worked for years and years on the railway at the LMS. And so I asked for permission to join up, and I was given permission. And that's where I ended.
Well, I just want to say thank you for your service to your country, Nancy.
Well, thank you
so much.
Thank you indeed. May I shake your hand?
Oh, no, it's my pleasure to shake yours.
Thank you.
Are you daughters?
Yes.
Both of you?
Yes. Linda, the elder, and Priscilla.
Are you proud of your mum? You obviously are.
Yes.
Knowing her name will be on that wall forever.
Yes. It's a good feeling,
yeah.
But we didn't know much about her work here.
No,
she
never,
very recently is, because she wouldn't speak about it.
She was doing her service and... Like a number of veterans. I mean, Nancy's not alone. We have ladies who don't want to talk about the work they did. They're happy to say that they were here. But, you know, they signed the Official Secrets Act. And as far as they're concerned, as Nancy just said, you did that for the King, didn't you?
I think it was because my mother swore on the Bible.
Yes.
That was the main... was more important to her than the Official Secrets Act, wasn't it?
Well, yes.
Really?
It was.
You know, I thanked her just now for her service, but... Her service has continued, really, because she's kept that secret, not just for the 30 years she could, or, you know, since the letter told them all they could talk about it, she's still keeping that secret now.
She never even told our father, and he was, as I say, he was a Royal Engineer.
Mm. He was the one in France.
He was the one in France, the boyfriend, she wouldn't even tell him. He didn't know what she had done, did he? He had no idea what you did during the war.
No.
Wouldn't speak about it, just that she was a Wren.
I told him to go on open day and read a book.
I'm Geoffrey Pigeon. During the war, I was in MI6. I joined MI6 at Wadden, late 1942, early 43. And I served in MI6 until it became in Singapore. It was handed over to the Foreign Office and called Diplomatic Wireless Service. The whole unit broke up. It became really divided into Her Majesty's Government Communications Centre, and that was at Hanslope, and the rest of the chaps went down to GCHQ at Eastcote.
So you were working with the people in MI6 who were setting up the wireless station here back in the beginning of the war?
I knew the people simply because they lived with us in 1939. But I wasn't here. But I do know from them and first-hand knowledge how this was originally set up. And it started off with some of these naval chief petty officers that are in my book and some of the Philco wireless people who had worked with Richard Gambier Parry. Richard Gambier Parry was headhunted by Sinclair some months before he bought Bletchley Park. And his role was to head up a new communication unit for SIS. And first and foremost, he upgraded their places at Barnes. That was the SIS receiving station. And then they were building a wireless station at a very high part of the North Downs in Woldingham called Funny Nuke. And those same people suggested my father would like to join, and we came down to Stony Stratford, and that's how I became part of it. Not badly done.
Not at all. So we've got these engineers who are like part of the backdrop of Bletchley. You know, they're fundamental to the Bletchley story. Mm. And there are lots of other things that happened here at Bletchley that don't kind of really come up into our stream of consciousness, like the food, you know, the people who cooked the food and the transport and things like that, isn't it? But they were really important parts of the whole story.
Yeah, they're not just peripheral. I can't talk about the food. My mother might do if she were still here, but the transport was vital. As my father and I caught the coach at Horse Fair Green, 8 o'clock each morning, to come to Wadden, so my mother caught the 8 o'clock bus outside the Plough. These had been all round the villages, Bradwell, Haversham, Wolverton, Newport Pagnell, Old Stratford, Stony Stratford, of course, and the same was happening all round. That's why there was such huge mileage. And the transport was a vital part of the whole operation. There were three shifts here, 24 hours a day. And it wasn't just the coaches bringing barrows and forwards. There were materials moved around in little Austin vans. It was a hugely important part.
What was your mother doing here?
My mother was a nurse in the clinic. And I just had great pleasure, the guide in the hall, was showing somebody the tapestry. And there's loads of huts woven into the tapestry. But one's got a red cross on the front of it, down the left-hand side. This lady came over and I showed her the hut. My mother worked from, 42 to 45. And then she inherited the family business. And so I came home in 47 and joined the family bathroom business. And that's what I've done ever since.
So MI6 and Bletchley Park, GCNCS, you know, it's a real family sort of business, isn't it? You know, with your father involved as well.
And my younger brother, Trevor, he was a graduate from Liverpool University, first class degree in French and German. He was invited to join SIS and worked with them for 33 years.
Wow.
And I think he controlled MI6 throughout Southeast Asia. And I think he was deputy. But I was here when Keith Jeffrey launched his book, MI6, and I met Sir John Scarlett, and he said, I work with your brother Trevor. Trevor was a very senior man. So there you are.
A real family business. Well, I can just imagine Christmas dinners, all the family round. How's work? Complete silence.
Trevor wouldn't talk about anything.
Well, thank you very much for taking your time to speak to me today.
It's a bit hit and miss and all over the place, but...
No, it's lovely. Real gems in there.
Well,
thank you.
If they're helpful. But they've got a loop of me all the time, 8 till 5, some poor devil's got to listen to me on a tape in the garage up here. And a lady said to me, was that you? I said, yes, I'm sorry. I did that when I came here for the first time with Sarah, when they'd first put it in. And she nudged her husband. I think that's him. I don't know how they recognised that. I had hair then. There we are. Great fun.
Well, good luck with the book.
Hello.
How are you then?
I'm very well. Sarah, this is Pat.
Lovely to meet you.
Well,
how are you?
Lovely to meet you, yes. What a nice day. I've never been to one of these before. So.
How was Edinburgh?
Oh, great. We had over 300 people, which was nice. And they're a very nice audience. They all stood up and applauded at the end. Because Tessa Dunlop interviewed Ruth Vaughan and Betty Webb and my sister and me about our exploits. That was great, and we enjoyed ourselves. So it goes on.
What are you doing now? Are you going to get something to eat?
I'm due on a veterans tour.
So shall we walk you over there?
Yes. I don't have to do it, but I think I'm
too stupid.
Ah, you've never said anything stupid yet, Mum.
Oh, thank you, Tony. Yeah, so, sorry, it's more my children coming
that's
in.
That's all right.
Christine Brose.
I think you've got a record today for travelling the longest distance to come to our reunion.
From Tasmania.
Yes. And have you come just specially for today, or are you on a long visit?
No, for today and see my friends and relations here.
Did you come from Australia originally?
No.
How did you end up in Australia?
Seeing the world after the war, yeah, and travelling around various places and married an Australian and stayed there.
Who have you got with you today? You've got at least one son. Is it two sons?
Two sons. This is a cousin and another cousin. An awful lot of us three.
Now, during World War II, you were at Bletchley Park.
Yes.
Now, where did you work at Bletchley?
Hut 8.
Now, before we sat down to do this, you said to me, oh, I didn't do anything very important.
No.
But you worked in Hut 8, which was one of the most important huts.
Yeah.
What were the names of some of those unimportant people you worked with?
I really only remember first names until I meet them, Sylvia and those sort of things, you know.
What about people like Hugh Alexander?
Oh, yes, I knew him.
This is what I mean. You're all so modest about what you did.
Yeah, no, well, he was there. He was our boss.
I think you've got a story about him and someone else visiting one day. Churchill?
Well, I wasn't acquainted with Churchill. He maybe touched me, I don't think he did, maybe leaned over behind me and said something about I was doing all numbers and numbers and numbers at that point. And he said something which sounded extraordinarily stupid about where was the German or where was the text or something. And Hugh Alexander, I think, behind me said something again, I thought rather short, that this was to do with the computing part, you know. And anyway, they moved on and I giggled at the end.
How old were you then?
Oh, I'd have been 18, I suppose.
Did you come here at 18 then?
I came at 17 because they didn't take you in the army until you were 18. And I left school and came here at 17.
And what year was that?
41.
So very early, weren't you?
Yeah.
You basically joined up as soon as you could. You wanted to do your bit.
Yeah.
Is that what you felt at the time?
Well, no, the thing to do, my brother was in the army, and, I must do something, you know?
That's what I hear from so many veterans.
Yeah.
You know, their dad had been in the Great War, or they got a brother who was serving. And...
No, never any question that I shouldn't do something.
Mm.
And so as soon as I was 17, whoops, I was off.
And were you Foreign Office staff?
Yes, I suppose I was. I had an interview in London. Room 46 was spies and room 47 was us, I think. Went up there and ticket to Bletchley, 2 weeks close, and somebody will meet you at the station. That was it.
Did you have any idea what you'd be doing when you came here?
No, absolutely none.
Was it just sold to you as a clerical job or something?
Yes, that sort of thing. I mean, I could just type, but I'm not a cleric trained, no.
And how long after you got here did you realise, oh, this is something a bit special, isn't it?
I never did, I don't think.
Did you not? Did you not? Well, you knew it was code-breaking, I guess.
No, not at all.
Really?
I arrived, and an Air Force chap met me at the station. He was driving there, drove me up, dumped me the door, went up and saw Travis, or whoever it was, in charge then. Signed the Official Secrets Act, told to go to Hut 8, and started straight off. Given a sheet of paper with four-letter words, you know, they're not what you call groups on them, and this is a German message, and I said, well, I don't speak German, you know. Anyway, that was all right. And then I had to do a Banbury. We were on Banbury. So I showed how to push a ruler along and mark off all the notes. And then the next thing is you go and punch holes. Then you had your sheet of holes. And then about the second day or so, you were advanced and you did comparisons and you slid your Banbury one on top of the other. 13 letters one way, 13 letters the other way. And, counting how many holes met, but we had lots of groups of three and you wrote it down on another bit of paper. And if you met a group of six or seven, was terrific. They got very excited and shot that straight through to the crib room to be turned into German or whatever. And that was it. I did that for, a year and a half, solidly. And then there were other things they put on, other isthmuses and things we did.
You're one of the few people left that did that sort of work.
Yes, but, 12 or 16 girls, reasonably sensible and tidy, could do all this paperwork, but of course had to invent a computer.
Did you stay in Hut 8 the whole time, or did you move around?
I moved around in other parts of Hut 8, and I was keen to learn everything. So, you know, you got a day where there wasn't any work. I was the first to want to go work in another section.
And they let you do that?
Oh, yes.
Oh, really?
Well, after all, Hut 8 was the top of the private things. Well, I loved seeing what else. I did some Italian things on Italian. You wound a little handle and lots of paper to throw away. I don't remember what we were doing about it, but doing that. and I worked with Alan Ross. He had a section. He rather wanted me to go and be with him permanently. And when I asked Alexander, he said, "Don't know how you've got the face to ask. Aren't you happy?" You know, okay, shut up about this. I was much happier in Part 8 than whatever he was doing, sorting them or something of that sort.
What was it like working for Hugh Alexander?
Oh, very nice. I can't think of working for anybody else. No, he wasn't angry. I do remember once I was doing something a bit special, doing an adding thing, you know, and he came round with an American woman, I don't know who she was, but she was somewhere attached there, and he was sort of showing her around there, and leaned over the back of me, and she said, "This gal can't even add up." And so then I showed it to Hugh, and he said, "No, it's perfectly right, you keep on going. You think you had to add two easy letters and subtract another, you see?" So she'd sort of say 8 and 7 doesn't make 9 or something, you know. And of course it did the way we had to do it, and it's quite all right. "How long would you take you to Fiji?" I was stupid enough to say it's about 3 hours. I was doing it all next day. I felt he was quite pleased the way I was doing it. That was something to help him make the bomb things go right, yeah. And I thought it was funny. This girl can't even line up. Interfering herself.
When you look back on what you did, are you proud of what you did?
Well, not a matter of being proud. I was happy. Yeah, no, I wasn't particularly. I'd probably be more proud to be running around in the front line or nursing or something, but it didn't come my way.
But it was as important what you were doing.
Oh, yes, I knew it was important. Oh, I loved it.
Because you should be proud. You should be very proud of
Well, they were very, very good in Hut 8, I don't know about everybody else, of telling us our results, which made all the difference. Because I remember after the Americans came in, a fellow came down, apparently the girls over there, they're trying to have one, they're telling you they're counting potatoes in Idaho or something. Well, heavens, when you're killing German left, right and centre, you make counting potatoes is rather dull.
It's interesting that you say that you were told what happened, because not many people were.
No, I think possibly that was Alexander, I don't know. As far as I knew, I always knew what was happening. But well, when we got good results, shut up and submarine gone, you know, that kind of thing. They told us, yeah.
We've done episodes on pinches and breaks.
Oh, yes, a pinch.
Yes. Would you see that material when it came in?
No, because it went into another room. They weren't going to waste time showing it to me, you know. That sort of junk went further down the passage. I didn't actually see it. We'd heard it had been done, of course, you know.
Was there a different atmosphere in the hut when you knew someone's coming
delighted.
In?
And that's when we had a pinch or something good like that. It was great, yeah.
Your two sons are here today. How proud are you of her?
Just.
Do you realise how important the work she did was? It wasn't just she was here. She was working in one of the most important departments in the entire establishment.
Well, quite an emotional day for us. Yes.
I could see. That's.
Yeah, I never talked about it at home. My husband's German, actually.
Well, so
he was fighting on the other side. Actually, here once it was in Scotland, and there was a local dance, and the Canadian sat down and said, "Was my husband in the war?" And I said, "Yes, but he was on the other side." "What? You were in one of them crouts?" David was furious having his father called one of them crouts. You know. I just thought it was terribly funny. The poor Canadian was so embarrassed after.
It's been an absolute pleasure to meet you today.
Well, thank you.
And I hope,
don't know what I've said there.
And I hope you realise just how important the work you did was, because it was.
I didn't do realise all that, no, but it was all fun to me then. I mean, not fun, you know, but life, yeah.
That's lovely to hear. And can I just say one last thing? Can I say thank you for your service?
Thank you. Oh, thank you very much. What did I say for this? Don't mention it. All these people are much more important.
You were telling that boat thing that you found out.
What is it?
Yesterday. The two ships which went and docked in.
Oh, well, that was a mismatch. Don't put this on there.
is to do with the work that Bill Tutt did. That's how he broke the Lorenz, was on squared paper.
Yeah, but that was before Colossus, wasn't it?
It was before Colossus.
Obviously, if you did something which you then had to take to the lady at the end of the room...
Yeah, you know, if something clicked, I don't know, I can't remember.
Yeah,
it was a leading wren.
It was part of the process.
Yes, at the end. And they kept it. I've often thought, what was I doing afterwards? Oh,
and
thank you.
It might sort of, you know, spark some memories.
Yes. Well, they had to give me something to do to keep me off the streets. You know?
Well, of course, you could have been doing knocks and crosses, of course.
Exactly what I said. It could have been quite easily. Anyway, thank you.
Well, my name is Joan Smeaton.
And what was your role during the war?
I was an interceptor.
Here, at Bletchley Park?
No, not at Bletchley, but Scarborough.
Yeah.
You could see Scarborough and Flowerdale.
And what did you have to do?
Take down masses and masses of code messages.
How were you recruited for that?
Oh, because I was brought up in the west of Scotland, and when I started off in the Land Army, which didn't appeal to me whatsoever, not up there. And then I think about a week or two later, when I still didn't know quite what to do, the Navy had a recruitment thing in the local hotel. So I went along and joined the Wrens.
I bet you didn't know that you'd be...
I didn't, because what I wanted to do originally, because I was a country girl and brought up on an island, I could row, I could sail a boat. I was very, very useful on the boats. And the Wrens had just brought in a new category, which was boats crew. And I thought, well, that's for me, obviously. But when I was interviewed by the Wren officer, she said, oh, yes, lovely that. But she said, I'm afraid it's very, very popular. And she said, what else would you like to do? And to this day, I don't know why I said wireless. I mean, I wasn't particularly interested in... So that was it. I was up within a fortnight. I was down in London, and then I went on the course and learned all about it, except what it was we were going to do. I mean, I didn't know till years later. And so I spent nearly 3 years at Scarborough intercepting.
And was it hard keeping it secret?
No, because I think they were very clever. They didn't give us enough information to think it was any worth exchanging or telling anybody. I mean, I never told my family. All they knew was that I was a wireless operator. Mm. That was it. And quite frankly, we didn't know ourselves how important it was. We never knew what happened to all this German Enigma stuff we were taking down from subs. Once they were put on top of our machines and whisked away, we didn't know where they went, what they went. I think maybe they might have given us a little hint and made it more interesting. We might have been a bit better operators if we'd known a little bit more. But as it was, you know, night watch, you got fed up and signals weren't very good. So anyway, it all worked out in the end. But as I say, I wish I'd known earlier so that I could have told my family.
So how did you feel when you did eventually find out how important your work had been?
Things began to click into place then, you know. The answers came to me. Well, that's why we did so-and-so, and that's why. Oh, yes, of course, I see now, but we didn't have the information.
Do you use the skills that you learnt
anymore? I can still do the Morse code, but I don't use them, no. I did for a short time, because I lived in Africa for 13 years after the war, and I joined the local police force out there, simply because I could do Morse, and they wanted somebody to. Not that I haven't ever had to do it, but I was there. I spent my 13 years in Africa. My husband was a vet, and so we were in the bush a lot.
I guess you didn't really think about it. It was just a job you did during the war.
I mean, I got married again because my first husband died in Africa, quite young. I remarried, and my second husband didn't. He was an ex-bomber pilot. So my first husband was in the Royal Army Veterinary Corps, so it was Army, Navy, Air Force. We never actually, you didn't talk much about it in those days, just in wireless.
No. I think that's what people these days find so hard to understand, because we're all sharing our feelings all the time.
I know. But in a way, I think it's a pity, because, I mean, I've been asked in the meantime, my family want me to write my story, and I've got my childhood and the war done, but I've still got to do my African years, and... The trouble is recalling, and the older you get, unless you meet somebody who's been in a similar position, and they say something, you say, I remember that, you know, I remember that place at Scarborough, we used to go dancing on a Saturday night. We enjoyed our life there, it wasn't too bad.
Don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.
Thank you.
My name is Mary Heal, H-E-A-L. I was 17 when I joined up and was stationed at Chicksands, which was Y service, and it was listening in station for Bletchley, because we had no idea that what we were doing was so important to the war effort.
I've heard it was really quite a boring job.
Yes, because it was, wasn't a wireless operator. I was the next cog in the wheel, the teleprinter Morse slip reader. I could read the Morse off messages and transcribe it into plain language and onto the printer.
Okay.
When the messages were coming out on ticketing.
You had to concentrate to quite a degree to get the accuracy.
The concentration was immense. The fact that it was an all-out war effort, you know. There wasn't a moment of the day or night from the start of the war that those messages were being, enemy wireless messages were being intercepted. We worked a week of days, 8 till 4, and 4 till midnight, a week of evenings, and a week of nights, 12 till 8 in the morning, and the work were kept fully occupied for the whole 8 hours we were on duty.
Quite hard going.
Yes, oh yes. Time was off the utter input, not a moment had to be lost.
It's probably a good thing that you were all as young as you were.
Oh yes,
that level
well
of
that's
concentration.
True. But to give you an indication how concentrated the work was, that every 3 months or so the RAF had a beautiful large house in the next village, and we were given leave there for a week every 3 months or so just to take the pressure off. But yes, we accepted it, you know, as I said, we had no idea how important it was.
When did you find out how it had
13 years later, when Bletchley opened its doors and windows.
Did it come as a shock to find out how
important it was? Well, we're amazed. I mean, I wear this today in memory of my late husband, because he was an air crew. He had been a navigator in Lancasters. He was shot down, taken prisoner, rescued by the Americans, brought back to this country, made well again, but never flew again. But he became a code and cipher officer and came down to Chicksands. He was actually at GCHQ, but he came down to Chicksands to see what we were up to. And I got my eye on him. And we were married 3 years later. He was a lovely man.
Oh, good
I miss
for you.
Him still.
My parents met in the Air Force.
Did they?
Yes.
Yes.
At Wittering.
Oh, yes.
We always had to salute when we drove past it.
Yes.
So you must have discovered with your husband then sort of the importance of what you'd done and...
Oh, yes. So very proud of being part of it. A very small cog, I may say, in the bigger wheel. But yes, oh, yes, absolutely.
And we keep finding out more as the years pass as to how many cogs there were in these wheels and just how big an operation it was.
Well, yes, that is true, yes. Yes, because I was 17 when I joined up, and I'm coming up to the big 9-0.
Good for you. I hope you have a big party. I see you've bought a brick in the Codebreakers wall.
Yes, yes, yes. I've just been in. I've seen it, and my husband's alongside of me. Yes, that too. I'm very proud to be up on the wall.
That must be quite special to have.
It was. It is.
Too.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Well, good for you. Thank you very much for your time. You enjoy your day.
Thank you.
Derek Dodd,
I was an intercept operator in the Y group.
Did you get drafted or did you join up?
I joined up because I was just become 18, and that was a thing to do at that time. When you were 18, you were either called up into the mines.
So you did it to avoid the mines.
Yes, I went and volunteered for the army. My choice was the Royal Artillery because that was my father had been in the Royal Artillery, you see. But they weren't recruiting for the Royal Artillery at that time. So I said, well, what else is there? And they said, Royal Corps of Signals. You'd be a wireless operator. So I hadn't a clue. I mean, I was never a Boy Scout and I had no idea what it meant. And someone then came along and said, you're in the Royal Signals. You will eventually be a wireless operator, but we've got to train you. So they sent me with another crowd and we were in an old converted mill.
Wow.
And we were there for about 4 weeks. I swept floors from morning till night, never touched a radio, anything to do with radio at all. And then one day, an officer came from London. They were looking for people who were interested in a special job in the Royal Signals. And I thought, well, this is better than sweeping the floor all the time.
Yeah.
So I volunteered. And the next thing I knew, I was sent to the Isle of Man, all places, to train. And there I learned, I became a special wireless operator, and I trained there on the Isle of Man from March in 1943 until October.
Wow. Was there, like, army barracks on Isle of Man?
No, we stayed in the hotels on the front at Douglas.
Oh, you did?
Yes.
You got to stay in a hotel?
Yes. Well, we had one lot of hotels, and the next lot of hotels for us were Italian prisoners of war.
Oh.
We spent 7 hours every day learning the Morse, including the Japanese Morse codes. But mainly they were concerned with the operating systems rather than the Morse itself, so long as we learned the Morse thoroughly until we just fought Morse.
Yeah, so it's like learning a new language
and
hearing it all
that's
the time.
Right, yes, when you heard tapping it, you automatically wrote down X or whatever it was.
Because I've heard some people say that they even spoke to each other by saying, did it da da da?
Yeah. Oh, yes, you could. Yeah. Yes, you could quite easily.
Yeah.
And then I was sent to join a unit which was being formed, 7th Section of Special Wireless, it was called. We became an operational unit. We were no longer training. And eventually we were sent to Bishop's Waltham, just outside Portsmouth. And that was in March of 1944. And of course, as you know, D-Day. So we were then set up as a proper unit. We were under canvas in a field and didn't have set rooms. We had, I can only describe them as single-decker buses with radio sets inside them.
Right.
Instead of seats, you had a radio set and a table. And I think there were 6 in each of these. That was our operating methods, where we operated from. And then, of all things, I was on duty at midnight on the day. We knew nothing about what was happening, except that all the fields around us between Winchester and Portsmouth were filled with American soldiers under canvas. And suddenly, one day, they all disappeared. Went out one morning and all the fields were empty. Just the canvas tents, the men had gone. And that, of course, was just a couple of days before D-Day. And when they went down to Portsmouth and all the other places to get the boats. And that night, it so happened I was on the midnight shift. And before we went on, we had an intelligence officer who used to come on shift with everyone each time, you see, to give you some idea of what you've got to listen to. I can't remember his actual words, but he said something like, it's a special night tonight. You might hear some peculiar things. Don't miss anything. That was the sort of instruction that we got. That was for the shift.
Wow.
And then, of course, we heard the planes going over us. And so we knew that there was something big. And then because it started and the radio suddenly started saying all sorts of things. And, of course, the German operators, radio operators, were very, very good. They were first class so far as security was concerned. So you know, if you found something different, you wonder what it was and made a note of it. And that night, you got all sorts of things happening. Messages from frequencies you'd never even heard of and all sorts. Next morning, of course, we were told.
So the only way that you could tell that anything different was happening was the frequency of the messages?
Yeah, that's right. Except that you suddenly found that you were getting messages in German, which they never, ever did. That was breaking their security. They never used plain language messages. Suddenly, you were getting the odd one coming over, which is what they obviously wanted us to catch. That's why they said, don't miss anything.
So the Germans were basically slipping up because they were being put under pressure.
Yes, that's what it was.
That's incredible.
I wasn't a German speaker, but I'd had 5 years learning it at school. So I knew enough to recognise it when it came in as, rather as being the normal code, I could recognise German words. And then when the war ended, they didn't need us doing this anymore. But of course, the war was still on in Japan.
Yeah.
So I was sent to join a unit that was being formed to go out to the Far East, down at Baldock in Hertfordshire. We started covering the Japanese shipping and so on until the bomb dropped, and that closed us down because that was the job finished, so I thought. Instead of which, I was sent back to Harrogate, which was the headquarters of us, and it was high-speed Morse. You couldn't write and copy it down as we had been doing all the time. It was all sent automatically on tape. So he spent the whole of his shift trying to work out on a bit of tape what the message was. 300 words a minute. It came out on the tape, not as a dot and dash, but as gaps. We translated the gap into an A or a B or a C.
Oh, my God, making my head spin.
Did that until the war finished.
So, as we look back now, how do you feel about that time?
Well, I can't remember. I was only 18 years of age. Like any other 18-year-old, I was more interested in football and cricket than war.
And did you get to play any of those?
Oh, yes, yes. Played a bit of football and a lot of cricket. I liked cricket. Played that up to quite an old age, really, for a cricketer, I suppose. I must have been 60 before I finished playing cricket.
How did you feel when the book about Bletchley Park came out in 74?
It was very strange because I knew nothing about Bletchley Park. I mean, as far as we were concerned, it began and ended at a radio set. We took the message and it was gone and that was it. And we just waited on the frequency that we'd been given. We would wait until the next one came along and did the same thing. All we knew was we had dispatch riders, as you see them over there. We had the dispatch riders. We had two of them. And each day they used to get on their bikes, sail off with all our messages to some place called Bletchley. I had no idea where it was. It could have been north of Scotland, as far as I was concerned, anyway. And that was all we knew about Bletchley. But never inquired either. We weren't interested. We were only interested in our own little life at that time. That was all.
So the codes that you wrote down and then were taken off, it wasn't like that was something that you had to force yourself to keep a secret?
No, I mean, all I can remember is that when I went to the Isle of Man to join this particular Y group, as it turned out to be, I was asked to sign a bit of paper, which I said, because you were a soldier, you did what you were told.
Yeah.
So I signed a bit of paper. That happened to be the Official Secrets Act, but I didn't know that at the time. But it never really occurred to us to inquire.
I suppose what I mean is, did you understand enough of what you were doing for it to make sense to have kept it a secret?
Well, I never thought about it as keeping a secret.
No.
It just, you don't talk about it. As it happened, my wife was also doing the same job. You know, we could talk to each other about it.
Oh, right.
So, but nobody else ever asked me about it. This is a special story. I've told this story before, and I still like to hear it. After D-Day, 7th Section closed down, and we all went into different parts of the organisation. And I was sent up to Northumberland to set up a radio station at Belford, not far from Newcastle, right opposite Holy Island. In fact, where my radio set was, I could look out and see Holy Island. And we were billeted with a local farm, and they gave us one of their barns to live in. But we had set up the radio station, which was a van on wheels. And then we'd have the radio set inside it. And then you had to drive around 360 degrees all the way around it, sending a signal so that you could, what they call, calibrate the set. But the problem was where we were on the field was right by the sea. So we had to go down onto the beach with our radio truck to get right the way around. We got onto the beach and whizzed up and down on there, sending our radio signal. And eventually, the van got stuck in the sand. And we had to leave it overnight with the tide coming in. We went back next day and dug it out. got the van out and got everything back onto the land again. And that evening we were in a local pub and there was another unit, a Royal Artillery unit, who weren't far away. Said to me, just checking, I said, well, we'd be down on the beach today. I said, oh, where? Whereabouts have you been on the beach? We told them where we were. Oh, that's funny. We're there clearing the beach of landmines and we haven't done that bit yet. And we'd be chatting up and down the truck. So that was another bit of fun. That was army life.
Born to survive.
Same to this.
Oh, well, thank you ever so much for talking to me today. It's been lovely to talk to you, and I'd like to take this opportunity to say thank you very much for your service.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.